Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 52 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast with Dave Musgrave and Dylan Hales here to talk one of our favorite wrestlers. But first of all, Merry Christmas, everyone, including you, Dylan. How are you?
I'm splendid. It's been a long time since we've done a show, probably too long. We've both had a bunch of stuff going on.
It is too long. It's actually November 6th was our last one.
Yeah. It's been almost 2 months. So, but we're going to try and make it up to our loyal listeners with a quality show tonight, and then hopefully another show in a few more days for your annual year-in-review sort of best-of show. But other than that, I've actually been doing wonderful the last few days. And, you know, for those people who didn't hear it, Dave and I were fortunate enough to be guests on the DKP show for the Figure 4/Observer site this week for the Christmas party, stage two of the Christmas party, the three-tiered Christmas party. And that was a really cool show. And I want to thank Alan again for doing it, and Dean as well for doing it with us. And we'll have those guys on hopefully pretty soon as well. So we promise we'll be more active in the next month or two than we have been in the previous month and a half.
It was not lack of interest in the show. It was lack of time to breathe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, which, you know, in the moments you do have a chance to breathe, maybe some family is not bad either, so.
But that's overrated. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. So, our show tonight, I think, is topical with the holiday season because, as we all know, you know, the little baby Jesus was born around Christmas time or other times in the year, depending on which version of history you want to listen to. And the three wise men did come to see him, bringing frankincense, myrrh, and gold dust. So, because of that, we decided to celebrate the holiday season by talking about one of our favorite wrestlers, probably ever for both of us, and certainly currently, in Dustin Rhodes, a.k.a. Goldust. Do you want to talk about why you feel that is topical right now, Dylan?
Oh, well, I mean, for those who didn't listen to the show we did with Alan and Dean, maybe you're not subscribers to the Observer/Figure 4. Or maybe you just didn't hear the show yet. But the premise of that show was to, partially at least, to talk about my grandiose idea to do a top 500 wrestlers for this year, which Dave and Alan are going to join me in doing, or at least attempt to join me in doing, make an honest attempt at it. And one of the guys who came up a lot in that show, because of the, I guess it's fair to say year, even though it's only been the last 5 months, really, was Goldust because of how strong his run has been since he's returned to the WWE, and I guess it was late August. And, you know, he's somebody that actually we discussed, Dave and I had discussed doing a show on him, and in fact, on the entire Rhodes family before at various points over the last couple of months. So this is probably something that would have happened anyway. But the fact that he's in the midst of such a, I don't want to say it's the best run of his career, but such a really good run, I think, makes it makes him really topical in the sense that he's somebody where I feel like he probably has more of a buzz around him now, even among people who maybe weren't that high on him before, than maybe he ever has in his career, which is kind of crazy in a way, but in the other
especially,
in another way it's not, because he's so good.
Especially in-ring, right?
Yeah. Yeah, especially in ring. You know, this is, to me, and I mean, we'll try and do what we've done on other shows where we sort of take the timeline approach with the wrestlers and follow them in a linear fashion from the beginning of their career to the present. But I do just want to say, like, right now, like, I mean, I was amazed when we talked about this the other night on the show that, you know, you, Dave, said that right now he'd be your number two for the entire year of 2013. And even though there's only, I guess, like I said, 4.5-5 months of him really making tape with a few other random indie matches here or there. It's kind of, I really don't have any problem with that. I mean, if you want to take a second real quick Just to sort of not necessarily elaborate on that point, because we can come back to that, but talk about a little bit about why you think Goldust is so topical right now.
He's had periods before where he was great in ring. He's had periods before where he was great character-wise and gimmick-wise. And it seems like he's brought all that together now to be, I think, the best all-around he's been in his career. And not just in his career, but he's better right now than most people are in their careers. One of the things I know what we'll get to is, you know, I know when I've watched the set of his WCW work, it's just like you watch that time go by, and I was watching it and thinking, you know, like it doesn't even seem like he's doing that much differently. Like he does has the same moveset throughout, but you know, there's so many intangibles there where he obviously gets better year by year, and that's why it's good for a young wrestler to watch. And you know, he just really seems to have mastered all that now. I know in his 2009, 2010 run, I think it was, when he was working with Sheamus.
Yeah.
He was doing quite well as well. And, you know, but he's really getting a great platform right now. And that's really what works well with it. So.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that more, but I don't want to talk too much about that now, but I kind of wanted you to touch on that a little bit as well, since actually this was really your idea for a show. I mean, you're the one who mentioned it, and you mentioned it off air the other day when we were still on the line with Alan and Dean, and they were like, "Yes, you've got to do this."
Well, it's like, you know, just even talking about him the other night is like, wow, it's exciting talking about him right now.
Yep.
I remember the first time I ever heard of him was in Pro Wrestling Illustrated. 1988 was the year I started collecting that magazine, and that was the year he debuted. And I just remember seeing a picture of this tall kid who looked like Dusty and had, you know, blonde hair and bad dark cyber bear claws on the side, you know. And that was my impression of him, and he largely looks the exact same.
it is kind of weird. He doesn't look that much different in the face for a guy who's bled a lot and, you know, certainly lived a pretty rough life by his own admission at various points. He's not nearly as aged as you would think. I mean, you compare him to somebody like Regal, who has actually had a lot of the same problems and actually a similar career arc in some ways. And Regal, God bless him, he's still one of the best guys on the planet when they give him a chance. But you can tell Regal is his age. You know, like, you really can't tell that with Dustin. But, I mean, I remember him from 88, too. I know that him and Kendall Windham had the tag team, and I know they were on TV a few times. And I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but in my family, everybody goes by their middle name. And everybody's middle name starts with a D. There's four boys, I'm the oldest. And right around the time that Dustin debuted on WCW TV, my mom told me that I could name my what would be my second younger brother. She was pregnant at the time. As long as the name started with D. Well, my first choice was Damien, but she nixed that because she didn't want to have the Antichrist child. And I'm not making that up. She refused to allow me to name the child Damien. My second choice, actually, because of Dusty Rhodes primarily, but also because I knew he had a kid named Dustin, because I'd either seen him on TV or heard about him through announcers and whatnot. I'd probably seen him, actually, because back then I watched all the TV. My second choice was Dustin. So my brother is named Dustin. So in a weird way, my brother is actually named after Dustin Rhodes.
Your brother is so lucky that neither Dick the Bruiser or Dolph Ziggler are top.
Yes, that is good luck on his part. Actually, my dad's middle name is Dick. I mean, it's Richard, but he's a dick in more ways than one. So that was actually, I remember, I mean, I've seen the match that Dustin and Kendall had with the original Midnight Express. I know it's on YouTube, or at least it used to be. And it's a pretty good match considering how green Dustin is. But
he actually debuted before that, though. He debuted in Florida.
Yeah, he worked in Florida, and then he actually went back to Florida in 89, too.
Yeah, so he debuted in Florida, and I do remember, like, unlike the Giants, Paul White having his debut match in which he defeats Hulk Hogan for the WCW title, kind of. Dustin Rhodes debuted in a battle royal in Florida, where the territory was dead. But
yeah, I mean, the territory was practically non-existent. I mean, I guess that would have been the beginning of 88 when he debuted.
He started at that time. That was when it was restarted as Florida Championship Wrestling.
Okay, so they restarted that because in 89, I know when he worked there in 89, that was when they were doing the PWF thing.
Yeah, and that basically, PWF and FCW were basically one and the same.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
FCW informed the PWF kind of as part of it, so.
So,
he'd been down there, and then he came in. So that was about September he debuted. I do remember he supposedly, perhaps actually, wrote a letter into Pro Wrestling Illustrated as well, thanking them for the article and correcting them on his age. Now, God knows if any of it was right, but if that was actually done or if it was just like Matt Brock. But
is Matt Brock even real?
I don't know
which ones of those guys are real.
Eddie Ellner was. Matt Brock.
I know Eddie Ellner was.
No, Matt Brock was just Bill Apter's one of his secret identities. Well,
yeah, that's what I thought.
Bill Apter is the secret identity, and Matt Brock was just made up, as was Liz Hunter, I believe.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Liz Hunter wasn't real, but I think one of the other women writers might have been real.
Brandi Mankiewicz, I think.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly. Well, actually, I don't know if she was real, but that's exactly who I was thinking.
Yeah, no, I listened to Bill Apter talk about it on Meltzer's radio. So
got it.
But yeah, then in December, about December, Dustin came into WCW and teamed for a couple months with Kendall against the original Midnight Express of Condrey and Rose. Also faced off against, you know, a lot of the no-name guys. And that's pretty much it. And then basically Dusty left in December of 1988, went to Florida, and Dustin went back with him, which I think is probably his best bet at the time to have done that. In 1989, Big Steel Man, who went on to be Tugboat, had a big feud with Dusty. They were the
Uncle Fred.
Yeah, Uncle Fred. They were the big feud down there, and I think I do remember that there was seen an article on Dustin Rhodes being worked over by him in a match.
They did some good angles. Have you ever seen any of the PWF stuff?
No, I haven't actually.
Oh, there's a really good. There's a great Dustin Rhodes and Terry Funk match from there.
Great!
It's a real good match.
Terry Funk,
and they did like I'm pretty sure they did an angle where like they brawled out in the parking lot, like on a car, and I think Dustin got his ass kicked, and then like the Nasty Boys were somehow involved because they were there in that territory or whatever the hell term you want to use to describe it at the time. But some of that stuff is pretty good. I mean, again, at this point he was really green, but you could already tell that he was. I don't want to, you know, he gets compared.
March 11th, he had that match.
Yeah, and it's really good. And I don't want to say that. I guess in a way you could compare them to Barry Windham because they have similar looks in the sense they're both tall, but they're not necessarily. They're both good at wrestling, like they're not super tall guys, so you can buy them against a variety of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both sons of wrestlers. They're both guys who sort of got their feet wet in Florida. They're both guys who, to one degree or another, maybe didn't entirely meet their potential, although I think Dustin did more.
I'd say you could say they're both super tall, but they're not monsters. They're not monsters with their frames, right? So.
No. Although, you know, the thing is, like, about Dustin and Barry, too, like, if you would put those guys, like, in a full bodysuit with a mask, especially in a territory like Memphis, they could have gotten over as monsters. You know what I mean? Like, they weren't monsters, but largely I think it was because of the fact that of circumstance. I mean, most guys that height in wrestling that came in when they were at that point in their careers probably would have been given like the Lord Humongous gimmick or something close to that. But I believe, you know, because they were both sort of good-looking guys and who their dads were, they didn't necessarily have to do that. The flip side of that is in Dustin's case, who his dad was, I think, came back to bite him in the ass a few times, but we'll get to that.
So, yeah, he'd been in WCW up until February, actually. And then he went down to Florida for that little bit. And then he went off to Memphis, actually.
Yep.
There's records from there of, you know, him working with Tony Anthony, teaming with Ricky Morton at times. Jeff Jarrett as well.
I think he feuded with Gary Young there. Did he feud with Gary Young? Am I imagining that?
He very well may have. He had a match actually on. Looks like he had a match on TV, teamed with Dutch Mantel. You okay there?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay. Did I hear a laughter there? Or?
You heard my neighbor's dog, but it's okay.
Oh, that's what it was. Hey, I'm sorry if I mistook your laugh for your neighbor's dog. Okay. Some work with Black Bart there as well. So, I mean, this is pretty much all in Memphis. It was USWA at the time.
Yep.
I don't know if he made his way down to Texas with it at all.
I don't remember him ever working the Texas Loop. That's not to say he didn't. I should have asked Charles about that before we did this, but I'm totally unprepared because he would know immediately. But I don't remember him ever showing up in any of the Dallas results. Which he might have, but see, the thing is, I always get the impression from this part of his career, because it's sort of a Motley Crue stuff, because he also worked All Japan during this period.
Yeah,
and
what I wanted to get to, too, yeah.
To me, it's like he was kind of testing the waters a bunch of different places to see what was going to, I mean, it's not even like he was real, I mean, I guess he was working territories, but not in the traditional sense of the term, because A, the territories were all dying or dead, and B, I get the feeling that he was trying to figure out, like, okay, where's the best fit for me, you know, and what's best going to work for me. So, because everywhere he went, he was there for a while, long enough to maybe have made tape a few times or sort of establish a presence, but not really long enough to be even a star that you would recognize, because really, he did not become a recognizable star in any way, shape, or form until he did the angle with Ted DiBiase in 1990.
Yeah, and I mean, he flew under the radar, right? I do remember that he had enough, although they are Mark Awards, but I think for 1989 and the in Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Rookie of the Year, he was like in the runners-up section, you know? So he had some visibility from his work in Memphis with that, because he'd be in their ratings as well. Of course, who his father was did have something to do with that as well. But,
sure.
You know, he float note there. He also, it looks like he did shoot with Gary Young. He had a match with Soul Taker, a.k.a. Godfather. And he actually went to the finals of, I think, the Southern title tournament against Tony Anthony. And he had a match teaming with Jimmy Jack Funk against P.Y. Chuhai and Buddy Landell. I don't know why I think that's important. But, yeah, actually, that was Dallas. So he was working the Dallas Loop by the end of the year. Yeah. More interesting to me, or just as interesting to me, is that in 1989 he was working the All Japan Loop. He did a All Japan tour from March till April of 1989 with some interesting results in there. You know, he, Stan Hansen, and Terry Gordy lost to Jumbo Tsuruta, Shunji Takano, and Yoshiaki Yatsu. He and Harley Race lost to Masa Fuchi and the Great Kabuki. He teamed with Harley Race a few times. He teamed with Tom Zink as well, and lost to John Tenta and Yoshiaki Yatsu. I'd really like that match, I think. He has a singles win on April 8th, 1989, over Kenta Kobashi.
He was wrestling as Dusty Rhodes Jr. in Japan, too, if I'm not mistaken.
He was wrestling, And he and Terry Gordy lost to Abdullah the Butcher and Joel Deedon. I think we know who probably took the pinfall on that one. And teaming with Pete Roberts as well, who was a British wrestler, I believe. And
And Stan Hansen's best friend in the business.
So, which I don't know. I thought that was cool, like that section of Stan's book where Stan, my buddy Stan, you know. where he talked about how great a friend Pete Roberts was.
Yeah, that was one of the weirdest things ever. Like, of all the guys to be, like, close friends in real life, Stan Hansen and Pete Roberts are not the two guys you would assume would be chummy. But that just goes to show you that the personas of some of these guys are not necessarily...
Yeah, if you were to see those guys in normal life, you would think, yeah, they very well may be best friends. But to see their on-screen characters, it'd be like, no.
Very odd.
Yeah. That brings him into 1990. He actually started the year working in... Where was he going? He was in USWA still, so he's doing Memphis and Dallas. And, yeah, still working with Gary Young. Just trying to see if he had any really interest. A lot of work with Gary Young in that point. Did have a win over Frogman LeBlanc. I'm not going to make a joke about that, like I just... not even going to go there. And then... Starting in April, as early as April 1990, he was on television tapings for WWF. I actually find that very surprising that he was on there that early.
Well, I mean, the big angle that they did with him was, honestly, I was, I don't want to say I was.
Great debut.
I mean, to me, that was one of the best angles in wrestling, in the WWF anyway. During the early 90s. I don't want to say the best because there was a lot of good Jake Roberts angles during that period. But
one of them not being the earthquake one.
But they, to me, that was a really good, the way it was set up with like Dustin sitting in the front row. To me, the whole thing was great. Like, because they managed to put, well, the genius of that was, I think, the first example of Dustin really showing you how good he was at wrestling small, because he's in there with Ted DiBiase, who's kind of antagonized his family.
Yeah, so he does the angle where he shows up on TV. I'm assuming people have seen it, but Dusty...
Yeah, you can describe it.
Dusty wrestling in the ring, probably Savage, actually. I think it was on Saturday night's main event.
I think that's right, but I can't remember exactly offhand.
That's usually what they did in Saturday Night, is they brought back an old feud as part of a new feud, right? So he's wrestling, I think he was wrestling Randy Savage, and Dustin's at ringside, and Ted DiBiase and Dusty's ex slash, the woman who betrayed him in Sapphire come and sit down beside Dustin, and eventually they get into it, and Ted DiBiase challenges him to the match, lasting 10 minutes with him on TV, and that happened in Springfield, Illinois in October 1990. So if you want to talk about that.
Well, okay. First of all, back in those days, competitive matches that had an angle behind them on the syndicated shows were not very common.
No.
So, like,
outside
that
of Saturday
alone,
Night's Main Event, you didn't see
it. Saturday Night's Main Event wasn't a syndicated show. It was kind of like Raw that would show up every few months, not every week. you didn't see on Superstars the Challenge, which I think was already around by then, and stuff like that. You didn't see competitive matches very often at all. I mean, even the main events on those shows weren't really main events of note. It was usually like a top guy versus a job or something of that nature. And the way they did it is, Dustin was basically presented as a jobber in the sense that he was just this kid who didn't even know how to wrestle, who was just trying to defend his family honor and his name and not be made to look like a joke, and, sort of like a rite of passage type deal. And it's really funny because Ted DiBiase is not a small guy either, but Dustin's a big dude. And normally it would be difficult, especially for somebody who's still relatively green, I mean, he's only 2 years in at this point, to wrestle small in that setting, because you're a naturally big guy. You're kind of baby face, but you look tough. I mean, he never looked like a wimp. And to go in there and be able to work this underdog match, this 10-minute challenge, where basically DiBiase had to beat him in 10 minutes, or I think Dustin won X amount of money, if I'm not mistaken. the way they set it up was so good. The angle was great. The payoff of the angle was great in that match, and it was completely unique for television at the time because you didn't see anything like that on TV.
Yeah.
So they really, in a way, created a star. They just didn't really ever capitalize on it. I mean, during that period, the WWF gets a lot of credit for stars that they created. And I know he was still young in the business, but to me, Dustin Rhodes is a guy that throughout his entire career, there were moments where he could have been a bigger star, and either he screwed it up through, you know, bad maybe decisions in his life. I don't want to pick on the guy because he's turned his life around big time and is a huge asset right now. But or, you know, circumstances and other BS sort of got in his way. But, I mean, I remember as a kid marking out like crazy watching that live, thinking that was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen in wrestling. And that sort of reaction for me was usually reserved to stuff I saw in WCW/NWA. It was very rare that I had a reaction like that to anything that happened in the WWF.
And I think one of the things that really happened with that one too, Dylan, is basically it was part of Dusty Rhodes basically phasing out of the WWF.
Yeah.
Going back to WCW, and Dustin went with him and probably was as big a star there as he would have been with WWF at the time. But
that's certainly true in a lot of ways. I mean, Dustin is, and we'll get to that here in a sec, but Dustin is really, the way he's sort of been covered and talked about in wrestling media is bizarre. It's really odd if you go back and read things that were written about him. I'm not picking on any particular writer, it's not even exclusively negative. A lot of it was positive. He's a guy that starting in either 91 or 92, when they had the old worker polls, I think, for the Torch, even in talk in the Observer and other places, he would be talked about really pretty fondly as a talent. But at the same time, people would be like, oh, the only reason he's got a push is because of his dad. You know, so it was like people, and I'm not even necessarily saying that it was Keller or Dave Meltzer or anybody like that doing that. It was just, that was sort of how the readership responded to a lot of it. So you had this bizarre
that the readership of the audience of wrestling being half smart, still one foot in the smart door, one foot still in the dumb door.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to a degree. It was weird because I think you saw this reaction where people appreciated that he was good. It was all pretty much impossible to deny, especially by 92, that he was a really good worker. But at the same time, people just like reflexively assumed that he was, you know, we hated Dusty because Dusty supposedly is the reason Crockett died, so now we're going to hate his kid. it's really odd to go back and look at some of that stuff because it's literally talking out of the same side of the mouth, or out of both sides of your mouth. It's one of the weirder phenomenons in terms of how a wrestler was covered during that period. But
that angle then led up to the match at the Royal Rumble as well, too.
Which was kind of a disappointing match, I thought, but it wasn't a bad match.
I haven't seen the match in a long time, so it's hard to really comment on it too much. It is interesting, though, that part of the working up, leading up towards that match, they did have some of their matches on where Dusty and Dustin, you know, took on Ted DiBiase and Virgil on regular shows. But he also had Dustin had singles matches with Buddy Rose, time, but that, I mean, I wonder if that those were good learning experiences for him.
I would imagine that Dustin, and I don't know the guy personally. I actually did meet him several times when I was a kid during his WCW tenure from 91 to 94, when I would get into shows really early and almost always for free because I had, as I've discussed before, I had a friend, my best friend, his father worked the security for almost any show in this area. And he was actually one of the nicest of the wrestlers. It was not uncommon for him to come up and like give us a high five. He always remembered me and my buddy's name every single time that we come back to town without being prompted, which was pretty cool. But I'm hardly on a first name basis with him now is my point. But he strikes me as the kind of guy who...
I said, Aaron, you're glad it was him and not Buck Zumhoff? Sort of a joke for our audience, but I want to make sure you got that at least.
That's worse than your George St. Pierre joke from the other night. Dustin, he strikes me as the kind of guy who probably learned from a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you hear him talk now, like if you hear him at one of his seminars, which I've seen, you know, clips of a recent one he did where I don't remember who he shot it for, but, and if you hear him talk about wrestling now, like, he strikes me as a guy who took a lot of things from the good talent around him, and that's exactly what you would expect out of somebody who's turned out to be so good. So,
yeah. And a weird result from just before that Rumble match, too, is January 14th in Huntington, West Virginia, Sam Houston defeated Dustin Rhodes. Like, Sam Houston was barely in WWF at that point, and I don't know if they were trying him out as a heel, or but that's a bit of a weird result. So.
Another Battle of the Bulldog angle?
Yes, that's exactly what it was. maybe a battle of second-generation guys.
Maybe a battle of... Never mind, I was going to make a bad baby doll joke. I'm going to stop myself.
Okay, yeah.
I'll leave the comedy to you.
Or the attempts at comedy. Yeah, so that basically wrapped up his WWF tenure. They had the Royal Rumble match where they lost to Ted DiBiase and Virgil, and that's where Virgil turned against Ted DiBiase, which was, you want to talk about a slow burn. I think that's the slowest one WWF ever did.
That was also one of the absolute great angles that you'll ever see, too. That's another really great angle that they did. I thought it was great.
It probably speaks to the abilities of Ted DiBiase, too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that in some ways that was DiBiase's shining moment in the WWF.
Yeah. Before that WWF run though too, he did have two tours in 1990 of All Japan, and that's the first time he actually teamed up with Barry Windham that I know of. I'm assuming he didn't team up with him before that, and he had a series teaming with him. They had a couple wins, you know, some losses as well, in All Japan, and. You know what? I bet you those would be pretty interesting to see. And pretty much the match that's most known from that time is his. He did have a match at MATV against Davey Boy Smith.
Yep.
I know Will said it wasn't very good. I'd like to see it anyways. But he also, you know, had matches against Tsuyoshi Kikuchi and whatnot. And a guy that he seems to be intertwined with a lot, this person I didn't even know existed until I was reading this, is a. Mark Scarpa, who is the son of Chief J. Strongbow. So.
Yeah, Mark Scarpa is the guy who did the breakdancing gimmick.
Is he?
Didn't he? I'm pretty sure he is.
I know in this thing that this picture I've looked up, he looks very much like Dave Meltzer, and he has a... he wrestled as Private Pyle at one point.
He did a Sheet Rider gimmick.
Yeah. And he wrestled as Vincent Young, and he has an American vest, like kind of like Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah, dude, that's the guy. Yeah, he did the breakdancing gimmick. I'm like 99% sure of it. He was.
I won't go into betting odds on that one. Oh,
he
weird.
Was the
first in Stampede too.
He was the forebearer to Jack Evans.
Yes.
Although I don't think Jack Evans is the bastard son of Wahoo McDaniel. I don't want to imply that.
I know myself, like, I realized I was way too into Ring of Honor one day when I just caught myself sitting there thinking, man, I wish I could break dance like Jack Evans.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. So anyways, Dustin then goes into WCW, and the first big match, I'll call it a big match. He had the Wrestle War 91 match where he defeated Buddy Landell. And that was the match where I was like, wow, he's my favorite wrestler.
Good match, too.
Yeah. He just, you know, talk about a strong debut, right? So, and basically it was onward and upward from there, right? He was on all the pay-per-views. He'd always have a half-decent, you know, little win over something like that. And was getting increasingly better, higher profile. I remember...
he feuded with the York Foundation during this point.
No, that was more... Yeah, he started that, because the York Foundation at this point was Alexander York. She had Richard Morton, pretty soon.
Terrence Taylor.
Yeah, Terrence Taylor first, then Richard Morton, right? And
yep.
She was feuding with him and flirting with him. And I remember he kissed her on TV and then ends up marrying her. You know, usually
yep.
the opposite of a voyeur. Well, no, actually, usually it's they put you together on TV and you get together, or they break you up on TV and you break up, right? I do remember we got the Power Hour here on TSN, and it was usually a couple months behind. But I remember Missy Hyatt talking about him and referring to him as being this young hunk, and, you know, never heard anyone put it that way, because I guess Tony Schiavone in WWF at the time wasn't really saying that. You know.
So you heard there's this young hunk, and then you immediately wanted to see him.
I did, yeah. And then I was like, he's even more my favorite wrestler. I want to be like Missy Hyatt will want me. So I know his first kind of, I don't want to say it was a big deal, but it was kind of that summer he and Z-Man and Big Josh won the WCW six-man tag team titles.
The illustrious six-man titles.
Yeah, they won them actually, yeah, and they won them from Bad Street and the Freebirds, right?
They bought them from a homeless guy outside the building.
Yeah. And that
no,
homeless
no,
guy had gotten
good.
That homeless guy had gotten them when he was bumming change, and someone gave him those instead.
Upon these, you might get $10. No, that was. I remember. I think they actually had some house show matches that made tape too, if I'm not mistaken, at least one. What's that?
That six man team?
Yeah. I want to say those exact same six-man teams made tape as a on at least one house show match. You know, and I remember those matches being not necessarily out of this world great or anything, but I remember them being good matches.
Yeah, they're pretty decent, right? Yeah, they won the belt in August, and I would assume they'd have some good matches in them.
Yeah. I remember the matches being pretty good. Now, you know, yeah, and I don't remember the details of the TV title stuff and, like, when that feud started or whatever. But the first, I really liked the Terry Funk match from 89. I think it's a great match, especially when you consider how fresh Dustin is to the sport, being basically a year in at that point, if that. But the first really great Dustin Rhodes match, where I think he was and the 10-minute challenge is great, too. But the first match where I really felt like he was as much the driver as he was the passenger is that match from 91, Halloween Havoc versus Steve Austin.
Yeah.
To me, that's when we did this Mark's Choice WCW poll several years ago, God, like a long time ago now, but I think I had that match in the top 15 ever for WCW. Like, it's one of these matches that it probably is not well known. I mean, it was on a pay-per-view, so it's not entirely obscure. It's not like it was on the Pro or something. But it's one of these matches that's probably not very well known. I would guess, without knowing, that it was... Well, I would say, I would guess, without knowing this, that it was maybe not as highly regarded as I regarded it at the time. But going back and watching it, it really... to me, it was an excellent match. To me, like... You got the blood loss becomes a factor, and they end up working to a draw, you know, which was common in TV title matches in WCW. But the way everything was set up, it was one of those matches where, and Dustin is really good at this, but it was one of those matches where everything built logically to the next spot. And that, I would say that was the, you know, but where the Buddy Landell match, I think was a good performance and a kind of a good intro to him as being maybe a bigger star. To me, that match is a match where if you go back and look, you sort of realize, boy, this guy's getting really good. He's just, you know, he's one of the better guys in a company that has a lot of talent.
And even from the show that was, like, really looked at very negatively from that summer, the Great American Bash pay-per-view, him and the young Pistols of Steve Armstrong and Tracy Smothers had a win over, an elimination match win over Bad Street and the Freebirds, that I remember, like, he was the guy who won, and I remember that, like, I mean, that image stands out in my mind. And, you know, he's kind of starting to arrive then as well. So they did a good job with building for him, too. Probably, you know, and of course, it doesn't hurt. He would have been protected with his dad being the Booker, but it was good. So
yeah.
He was obviously a good guy to do it with, just based on his abilities. So. Yeah, and then, so yeah, that I remember that being really solid. That was at Halloween Havoc 91, the match with Steve Austin. I just remember being disappointed because I actually wanted to win the title. As great as Austin was TV champion at the time, you know, Dustin was my favorite. So, and then that leads to that was kind of like the breakout thing. And then he actually, so that's 91. He was also starting to team with Barry a lot at this point too. And they were feuding with the Enforcers. And at that same, around that same time, they had the thing where Barry got his, am I right? No, maybe, yeah, that was in 91, where Barry got his arm broken by the Enforcers, right?
Was that 91 or 92? I'm so bad, because this doesn't...
No, that is 1991, yeah. And it was actually, I think, at Halloween Havoc. I'm not sure who Barry had been supposed, who was supposed to wrestle that year, but he ended up... they were teaming. They were probably supposed to get the tag team title. I think Barry was maybe supposed to be in the that Electric Chamber of Horrors match or whatever it was.
Oh, yes.
With Sting and the Steiners and someone else against Cactus and Abdullah and Kevin Nash and Diamond Stud. Oh, Vader ended up in there, too. I think maybe that's where Barry was supposed to be, but it was on that show, I think, where they broke his arm in the car. And then it was at the November, same year, November 1991, is when Ricky Steamboat came back as Dustin's mystery partner, and they won the tag titles from Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Yeah, that was in Savannah. I was there for that.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, that was a great lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good couple months there where he has those big matches, right? That was November 19th, 1991. And then when you were talking about, you know, the smarky kind of approaches and stuff, I do remember reading about 1999, a review of that match by Scott Keith. Did you ever read much Scott Keith?
No, I managed to avoid Scott Keith. One of the great benefits to having come to the internet wrestling world the way I did is that Scott Keith was not a portal for me at any point.
You know what? I really enjoyed reading his stuff a lot at one point.
A lot of people do, and I actually have nothing against the guy.
Yeah.
But I, you know, and this was actually discussed recently. I'm not going to go into great detail on this, but this is might even be an entire show. But he's one of these guys who, for better or worse, probably has shaped opinion more than we know. And I take the position that it's probably for worse in a lot of ways, because I think there are certain people who have my open view of certain guys and certain eras in wrestling. But it's everybody, you know, it's not his fault that he had an opinion that a lot of people like to read. So.
Yep. And, you know, his opinions were shaped by other people as well. And
sure.
You know, and I think it's part of that whole one foot in the smart door, one foot out, you know, at the time, right? Because I remember he wrote, and this is in 1999, I think it was, he wrote, "That is the best match that Dustin Rhodes will ever have his name attached to." And while, you know, you could argue perhaps it is his best match, you could not argue that it's the only good match he's ever had, because that's what this whole show is about. So, yeah, him and Steamboat held the titles into 1992 when they lost them to Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson. That must have been, I wonder if those were good matches going around the horn.
I'm sure, I know they were, because I saw some of them live.
Yeah, that must be cool.
The whole Dangerous Alliance era, and I've talked about this before, that was one of my peaks as a fan. I mean, we all go through lulls and highs. For people like me, you never really get out of it. But that was one of my peaks as a fan, was that particular era. You know, a large part of that was because I was going to so many shows at that point, because I would get to go to the shows in Charleston and in the surrounding areas, and they ran very regularly in this area still at that point, partially because this was one of the few areas, I would guess, where they did decent houses, because business wasn't exactly good. But the Dangerous Alliance stuff, I mean, to me, that's another era where Dustin really stands out of the pack, because he was not the top babyface, but he was a guy that can be plugged in against any member of that, you know.
He was definitely the meat and potatoes part of that kind of.
Yes.
Effort. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he can be plugged in against any. It's in a way, he was kind of like the babyface version of Arn Anderson, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
He was the guy. He was the guy who, maybe he wasn't ever the biggest star during that period, but in some ways, the feud was the whole development of the feud, basically most of the babyface roster against the Dangerous Alliance, it was in a lot of ways heavily dependent on him, because Sting and Steamboat were the bigger guys, but Dustin was called upon to sort of be the young gun, the up and comer. Still, he's a few more years in now, but be the guy. It was a similar role to the DiBiase role, but with, you know, that he had against DiBiase, but with way more juice in the tank, because he was more polished at that point.
Yeah.
And,
actually, he was kind of the counterpart to Steve Austin, really.
In a way, yeah. But see, this might be a controversial opinion. In no way am I saying Steve Austin was bad at that point. But
I don't think it's controversial to say Dustin was better than him at that point.
Oh, I think Dustin was way better than him. Like, to me, Dustin in 92 was a great wrestler already. Whereas Austin in 92 was a guy who could have good matches against the right people, but he wasn't a great wrestler yet. And that's not his fault. It's just that's the way it was, in my view. Dustin,
he was
at that point, was outstanding.
I'm actually seeing that match where Anderson and Eaton beat them for him and Steamboat for the titles, it was 2 out of 3 falls. That must have been really good.
Dude, there was a 6-man, and I, from Saturday night, there was 2 out of 3 falls, which was like Babyface versus the Dangerous Alliance, which was a tremendous match. From May of 92, that was another really good one. One other match that really stands out from Dustin that year, and I don't even remember when the time frame is, but I don't want to forget it while I'm thinking about it. He had a match with Vader from WCW Saturday Night in 92. He had a more famous and arguably slightly better match in 94 with him, but this match was awesome, this match in 92. I mean, he bumped all over the place for Vader, but this was a match where he was sort of called upon to wrestle big instead of wrestle little, because he had to go toe-to-toe with this guy. And it was a great, great match. Probably not as good as the match they had in 94, but another example of him having a really good performance. To me, he was just an integral part of the Dangerous Alliance feud. I'm not saying he was the most important guy. That would be totally false. But it wouldn't have been the same without him. And this was also the period where I think he sort of became known as a tag team specialist. You know, I think probably starting with the Steamboat stuff at the end of 91 and then rolling through 92 is really when he sort of became known for, at least within the context of WCW, being the really good tag team wrestler, again, sort of similar to Arn Anderson, I guess, in a way. I remember that's what I thought of him as a kid. Like, not necessarily that I didn't see him as a single star, but I saw him as this great tag team wrestler, you know, sort of along the lines of Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson. And now here we are 20 years later, and I would say he's pretty well made a case to be the best tag team wrestler of all time. I mean, I'm not saying I would stake there's no way I would 100% say that at this point, but there's not many people
in the conversation,
Yes, and there's not many people that are in the conversation with him. There's like a handful.
Billy Gunn?
Yes, Billy Gunn would be one. Also, Headhunter B.
Another match that stands out as kind of a really cool memory as well is from January 4th of 92 on the New Japan Dome Show that year. He and Dusty teamed, actually, and defeated Masa Sayido and Kim Duck. So I remember watching that.
That is
cool.
Yeah.
Remember that treated it like a pretty big moment because it was on the WCW pay-per-view they did. So, And the other thing I wanted to mention, there's
War Games, too.
War Games, yeah. One thing I wanted to mention before before I forgot about it, is you were starting to mention his match with Vader in 92 and then again in 94. Our buddy Grimace, a.k.a. Steve, has an article that he did at the Place to Be website.
Yep.
On he's basically doing these articles called The Wrestler Snapshot, and I think he's doing a good job on them. And his first one was on Dusty, and his second one is on Dustin. So kind of going with that topical flavor as well. So check that out. Just search Wrestler Snapshot, Gold Dust, and Google, and I'm sure you'll find it. So, and he brings up the 94 Vader match, which is why it made me think of that. So, but yeah, they had, I guess they had the War Games match with the Dangerous Alliance that year.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is, a lot of people think, the best match in the history of WCW.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, the War Games match the year before as well with the Horsemen, kind of the last hurrah, the first era of the Horsemen was pretty good as well, but I think this is generally seen as better, right?
Yeah, I mean, what hurts the 91 match is the finish with Sid audibly calling spots on camera, even though the actual spot with Pillman was insane and really awesome. You know, it's something that is hard for people to get past because it's so egregious. It's probably the most egregious incidents of spot calling that you'll ever see in a live match.
They also had it. They also had it with him and Rick Steiner in that match too, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. There was a few. It was really bad in that match. You know, in this match, Dustin was really great in this match. In War Games '92, but
Stingberry Windham, Dustin Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, and Ricky Steamboat over Rick Rude, Steve Austin, Bobby Eaton, Arn Anderson, and Larry Zbysko. So.
Yeah, yeah. And Dustin was awesome in this match. This was one of his best performances ever. Maybe not his best, but, you know, in the top, absolute top tier. This is another match that I've seen people point to when they say this is when he became a great wrestler. I would argue it was before that, but I could certainly see how somebody would watch that match and think that this guy jumps out of the pack as a star. The match itself was just great, period. The thing about the Dangerous Alliance era in general is you had five heels where the worst guy was Steve Austin. Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
And on top of it, they had Paul Lee as a manager who was great, you know, and the heels or the baby faces they could work against. Every single one of them, it brought at least something exciting and different to the table. I mean, there's nobody they were going up against that felt boring or ridiculous. Like in 91, I mean, you had like the El Gigante stuff and all that. Like, not that he was in the match, but there were things sort of floating around.
Big part of that match, he was the one who carried Pillman out after.
That's right, he was. But you know, by 92, it just felt like a more serious ordeal, like the whole Dangerous Alliance angle and the War Games itself felt like a more serious ordeal. But, yeah, I mean, Dustin, to me, the debate for a while was whether or not Dustin was better in 92 or 94. Now I would say 94, but 92 was an awfully good year for him.
Yeah. And then he started teaming with Barry then, and That was such a good tag team.
Now, when I said there was a handful of guys who might be in the discussion with him for great tag team wrestlers.
Barry Windham. What,
yes. Barry Windham would be another one. And, you know, yeah, I don't even know what to say about that team other than the fact that they were great. I mean, it's amazing because these are two big guys and – think about it. In every single one of their matches, one of them had to play face in peril.
Yeah.
But they were able to do it and do it very convincingly. I mean, they had good matches against a lot of teams. I guess most famously would be the Williams and Gordy stuff.
They were in that NWA Tag Team title tournament that year, too, which is, you know, maybe some of it didn't come off that great in execution, but it was pretty awesome as far as some of the people they had in there, because I've seen results here where Windham and Rhodes beat Hiroshi Hase and Shinya Hashimoto. I mean, that's pretty cool. And
Yep.
Benoit and Lager were in there as a team, and they had the Silver Kings, which was actually Silver King and El Tejano. Were the Headhunters in it maybe too?
I can't remember. See, I get confused. I can't remember, were the O'Days in that tournament?
They were. And I think
okay.
the Headhunters were listed as in it, but it wasn't them. Or there's something like that. It was someone, something along that lines. Anyways, yeah. So maybe it wasn't the Headhunters, but whoever it wasn't them, and it was another name that was used. So, but yeah, that was a big tournament, and yeah, they went to the finals and lost to Steve Williams and Terry Gordy, and I remember that being a good match.
A very good match. Yep. You know,
really a good show actually, because I mean, that was the same show where Vader beat Sting for the WCW title.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the pay-per-views at that point were, a lot of the big matches especially were really great. That was a very good year in ring for WCW. Probably the best year they ever had in ring from beginning to end. You could, argue other years for other things, but.
And they did it even with Bill Watts' whole no off-the-top rope stuff, right? Maybe in-ring it did have the desired effect, you know? But still came off as lame, but you could just ask guys to not come off the top rope so much. But yeah, but him and Barry were teaming a lot at that point, and basically it led up to, I think it was October, where they won the tag titles from Williams and Gordy. Yeah, it was actually September 21st where they won them on TV. So I've never seen that, but I would assume it was pretty good.
It's really good. I've seen it.
Yeah. I assume the pop for it was pretty big. So.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, this is where when Cactus Jack was in, and it looks like he and Sting were having matches against Cactus Jack and Jake Roberts, which were probably pretty interesting. So yeah, they kept had those titles, but I think they were a great tag team, you know, pretty strong champions. I think the big thing is that it might have been overshadowed a bit by the fact that Barry was slowly turning heel at the time, leading up to them losing the belts to Ricky Steamboat and Shane Douglas, which is a team I really liked. I think most
which is a great underrated match, by the way.
Yeah.
And the angle with Barry turning on him and the slap and everything. I mean, that's another really good angle. That's a great match. That's one of those matches that I think gets lost in the sea of other good stuff that was going on that year. I think that was the best match Steamboat and Douglas ever had as a team. I like it better than any of the Hollywood Blondes matches.
That was Clash 21 in November 18th, 92.
Yeah. That's, you know, my favorite... My favorite match that team even. That's my favorite match that Steamboat and Douglas had as a team.
Did you see many matches with Wyndham and Dustin against each other during that time?
I don't remember if I ever saw them against each other or not.
I think it was pretty much cut short, but...
Yeah, there are certain things from that time period that I'm, you know... Really, I have a really, really vivid memory about, and other things that I don't have a vivid memory about. I don't remember seeing that, but that doesn't necessarily mean it didn't happen. They may have run McAllister with it, they may have run in Savannah or Columbia with it, but I don't remember seeing it.
Well, one of the reasons I think that you could see it as being cut short, the feud, is that Dustin ended up doing other stuff, which is good, because it was around this time that Rick Rude got injured as U.S. champion. And basically led up to a tournament where I think he beat Steamboat in the finals for the U.S. title. So
yeah,
that was his first singles title, actually.
Yeah, and at the time, the U.S. title was still a pretty big deal. But this was
yeah,
a weird period in WCW because this was also right around the same time as when Wyndham won the, I don't know if you want to call it the NWA title or the international title. Remember they had
that's
like
the easiest
two...
way to call it. He beat Muda for it, yeah. It's super...
Yeah, and actually Wyndham was really good too until his knee blew out or whatever in 93. I mean, he had some great stuff. So they kind of went their own separate ways and both won major titles. You know, it's weird because that NWA / international title, at least in theory, was a bigger title, but... In terms of how it was presented on TV, I never really got the feeling that it was any bigger than the U.S. title. So, it's kind of, it's not, I guess it's not that dissimilar from the way the SmackDown title was treated in the WWE in the last couple of years, but
yeah, it
was just
actually,
sort
it was
of bizarre.
Probably very similar to that.
Yeah, it's very bizarre, but
actually,
Dustin,
from Starrcade 92 at the Battle Bowl show, they had Vader and Dustin defeated Kensuke Sasaki and the Barbarian. There's an interesting.
Well, the thing about Dustin in 93, and I don't remember, you know, all the details, and actually the matches he had with Foley on the B shows may have been in 92. They had like a series of matches on, I want to say it was Worldwide Pro. I think one of them might have been like a False Count Anywhere match or something like that.
Oh, it was very early 93 that Cactus turned babyface, so yeah.
Yeah, and that was actually a really fun like TV angle that they did, because back in those days, since there weren't pay-per-views every month, you could actually do TV storyline. But, you know, that's kind of an unheralded cool thing. 93 is sort of a weird year for WCW in general, in my opinion, because 92 was such a high in terms of in-ring work, but the company obviously wasn't making any money. And in 93, it just felt like, to me, even at the time as a fan, 93 was a huge letdown from 92. In no way would I call it bad, but it just did not feel nearly as exciting as 92 it felt. And while it was certainly not a bad year for Dustin Rhodes, and there are matches you can point to that I really enjoyed that year, I feel like 92 was, I want to say 93 was an island in between the great years of 92 and 94, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Not a bad year, but the promotion was just, he had the U.S. title and did some other stuff, but it felt like every, he didn't have, even matches that on paper should have been really good, I don't think they were as good maybe as they should have been.
Can I flash back in time here for a moment?
Sure.
Because I'm going through some stuff. When we were kind of skipping over his Florida work in 1989, where Dusty was back there as well, so FCW was going, and they had the PWF, and the FCW title basically became a secondary title to the PWF title that Dusty had. But Dustin Rhodes was actually FCW champion, defeating Al Perez and then losing to Kendall Windham.
So that, you know, see, that's right there is probably why people thought Dustin Rhodes was overpushed. Stuff like that. That's pretty crazy. I actually didn't know that. Although I bet him and Kendall could have had good matches. I don't know if they would have had. I don't know if they would have been that good then, because he was still green. But
well, and that was Kendall coming out of having turned heel in WCW as well, right? So
yep.
I wonder. I'm sure Kendall went down as babyface, and that could have been cool. So, anyways, what were we saying?
Well, I was lamenting the decline of WCW in 93.
Yeah. 1993. So, yeah, some cool stuff. Dustin did have his U.S. title reign that year, and then had his series of matches with Rick Rude, which was, I don't know, as you say, he was already a great wrestler by that point, but it probably didn't hurt in kind of helping with his development as well. Because Rick Rude, in 1992 at the very least, if not the best, he was certainly top five wrestlers in the world, I'd say.
Oh, I thought Rube was the best guy in the States in 92 when I rewatched that stuff a few years ago. And in WCW alone in 1992, there was probably 15 guys that were out of this world great. So, you know, that's high praise. I will say I thought the Rube matches were disappointing. It's not that I thought they were bad, but I think my internal expectations for those matches were a lot higher than they actually ended up being. Whether or not that was booking or Rude being hurt physically and sort of breaking down, which is always possible, or Dustin, you know, still being, I guess, kind of green, although I think by that point most of the kinks were worked out. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I would say it's more of the first one, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. When I think of Dustin Rhodes in 93, and I mean, you can go through some of the stuff, but to me, I think of like I said, an island in between great years. It's not that anything was bad, but it was kind of almost like
CW in general.
Well, both, really. But yeah. I feel like it was a waiting game for him, too, in the sense that 94, in a way, this is going to sound crazy to some people, but in 94, there was a period where he was the babyface engine that was actually driving the company.
Yeah.
And in 93, he was a guy that was in the middle of getting his first big singles push, but he wasn't really, I don't want to say he felt forced, because I don't think that's true, but the situation in the company was so weird with the guys they were sort of bringing in and trying to rotate into title slots. And
maybe he was learning to be a single star.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a fair characterization. Also, it's important to remember he'd come off working in tag teams for a long time. So,
yeah.
You know, that's a little bit different. But
yeah, and a lot of internal flux in WCW as well. And maybe they didn't have the... maybe they didn't quite have the the booking down for him to have great opponents. Although I do think I would like to see May 18th, 1993, when he and Kensuke Sasaki defeated Fury and Rage of High Voltage. anyways, he had matches with Max Payne and with Rip Rogers that year as well. So,
yeah,
but then it all led up to the end of the year when he. Oh, yeah, 93 also had the stuff that, all that stuff where he was teaming with Davey Boy and Sting and the Shockmaster.
Yes.
Sid and Company as well, right? So
classics. Uncle Fred, come back.
Yeah. teaming with Arn Anderson. I think it was it 93 where Arn Anderson turned on him, or was that, I think that was 94.
No, that was 94.
Yeah. So
all the Sud Stable stuff is 94.
All the what?
All the sex stable stuff, all the Colonel Rob Parker stuff is 94, yeah.
I heard sex table, so sure that waited until then as well.
No, that's the Gold Dust stuff. We're not there yet, Dave.
We'll get there. That's Ahmed Johnson. this all leads up to Starrcade 93 is where he lost the U.S. title to Steve Austin. And maybe that's just kind of freedom of that, you know, that little part because... 94 was a big year for him. I gotta be honest, I didn't see a lot of it because I was away at university and in the military at the time. So if you want to kind of go through 94 and your memories of it.
I thought, you know, at the time he was maybe not my favorite wrestler, but pretty close. If he wasn't my favorite, I can't think of who would have been ahead of him. There might have been a couple of guys, but he was in that upper tier of guys that I was a huge fan of in 94.
Just one other thing is that he did have the stuff with Rick Rude. In 93, the title was vacated at some point, and then they filled the title in August. So anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing about 94 is, and I've talked about this before in another podcast, both with you and with other people, but to me, 94 is like the transition year where it was the last of WCW having any sort of connection to being the sort of... heir to Georgia Championship Wrestling and Crockett. After that, you know, the Hogan came in, I guess, in the middle part of the year officially or whatever, you know, and he, as the promotion started to get centered more toward him, all of his cronies came in, a lot of the old guys got pushed out, the style of wrestling changed dramatically, the emphasis in my opinion, quality matches and building compelling feuds really, really changed to the sort of cartoony stuff. And actually, as much as I hate to admit it, it was the right decision because WCW would have gone out of business probably for sure if they had kept going the route they were going without Hogan, whether I like it or not. But as a fan at the time, you know, this was the last stand, and Dustin Rhodes was kind of the babyface. He was the last babyface standing of that sort of traditional Southern promotion, whatever term you want to use. He was the last guy that sort of represented that. And
I think we can call it the old school wrestling promotions, really, because WWF was that at the time. And ECW was, but it was like a new modern version of it.
Yeah, and ECW was still brand new. I mean, yeah, they'd been around for a couple years at that point, but they were nowhere near what they would be even a year later. You know, the big jump for ECW really took place in early 95. But to me, this was, in a lot of ways, the best year of Dustin Rhodes' career. If somebody wanted to pick another year, there are other years that I think are in the discussion. But he was a guy. At this point, they gave him a storyline. And, yes, it was not in the main events always, although there were some slots where he did was high up the card. And, yeah, he was not – it was not a financially successful promotion for the most part. No, he was never the world champion. But in terms of being presented as a big star and being able to carry a feud that was really compelling – that drove a lot of TV. In a lot of ways, I would compare it to, like, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio's feud in 2005, where I don't know that was ever really a main event feud in the way that most of us would use the term main event, but it certainly was a feud that appealed to a certain segment of the audience. The matches they produced were, at least some of them, were excellent. And it's a lasting feud that I still think about, and that's sort of the first thing I associate with both of those guys, at least with their WWE careers. And with Dustin, the first thing I associate with his WCW career is the Stud Stable feud in 94. And, you know, watching it at the time, I loved it. Watching it back, I love it even more. I think the whole progression of the storyline is great because it goes from Dustin being sort of outnumbered, being double-crossed, to Dustin asking for help from, you know, Arn Anderson, to Arn Anderson turning on him, and which isn't really a surprise because of Arn's history with Dusty, which they sort of reference, and to Dusty being the guy that's finally there for Dustin, and then even then they can't get even the odds because you've got crazy Ming out there with Carl Robert Parker, who was portrayed as he was a bodyguard at the time and was portrayed as this invincible force that nobody could do anything to. You couldn't hurt him at all. You know, they did the big angle where Dusty broke the chair over his head and he no-sold it. And all of that built to the War Games match at Fall Brawl. But in the process of all of this, Dustin had, I mean, tremendous matches with Bunkhouse Buck. He had a couple of pay-per-view matches with Bunkhouse Buck that were absolutely out of this world. Excellent, excellent matches. He had TV matches with Buck that were great. He had the tag team match where Arn turned on him is actually a really great match. You know, he had, you know, they brought in Terry Funk, so it sort of turned into this, like, the enemies of Dusty Rhodes were coming to seek vengeance on his son.
Yeah.
That was sort of how it was portrayed, which, I mean, you don't get any more Southern than that.
Terry Funk and, everywhere that year.
Yeah, it was the way the entire thing develops is good. The promos in it, I mean, the promo where Dusty Rhodes agrees, basically begs Dustin to take him as his partner, you know, where, you know, is I would actually say the greatest wrestling promo of all time. I've never seen a better promo than that, ever. If anybody
certainly when you watch it, it's one of those things where this is the greatest promo you've ever seen. Like, even though you might say the same thing about another thing at a future time, you know, it's one of those ones where, you know, like where you watch a match and you're like, this is the greatest match I've ever seen. And, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. To me, it stands out. Like, when people nail me down and try and say, what's the best match of all time, my reflexive response is always the finals of the 1996 Tag League. And when people ask me what my favorite promo of all time is or what I think the best is, I always say this one. You know, like, yeah, there are others that are perfectly viable contenders, but this promo that Dusty cuts, you know, and it's after they did the angle, I think it was Bash at the Beach. I could be wrong. I can't. I'm not good with dates and stuff like that. Where Arn was supposed to be his partner. Arn was supposed to be his partner against Funk and Bunkhouse Buck, and Arn turns on him, and you know, it ends up he's got nobody to turn to, and then Dusty is the guy who begs Dustin to carry this old man's and let him be his partner. You know, he tells him not to beg another egg-sucking dog like Arn Anderson to team with him. And it's just this great promo because it plays off the real-life stuff.
Bash at the Beach, July 94, was where that happened with Arn.
Yeah, I thought that was. And like, that, the whole angle is so good. I mean, the matches are great. There's probably a half dozen matches that cover the major matches that cover the whole sort of story arc. And every single one of them is at least very good. And every single one of them logically sets up the next scene. And by the end of it, you know, when they build and they finally do the War Games, like, that War Games is such a great match, and that is a tremendous Dustin Rhodes performance. I mean, the whole match is great. You know, the Rhodes has had to recruit Dusty and or they had to recruit the Nasty Boys. There's this hilarious scene where they go to recruit them in this completely ridiculous stage set made to look like the lamest possible bar, tusk bar you've ever seen. And the Nasty Boys end up teaming up with them, and they did the big angle on TBS where Colonel Rob Parker was forced by the WCW matchmaker committee or whoever to be in the match instead of Ming. You know, and that was made to be a huge deal because he was sort of the engine driving all this anti-Rhodes behavior. And honestly, I can't. This might be my all-time favorite feud in wrestling, to be honest. Funk versus Flair is my all-time favorite feud, but this is right there with it. I mean, there's not a big gap between those two for me. It's a great feud. The payoff at War Games is great, and watching all this, you know, you get the feeling that Dustin is really become a huge, huge star. And in a lot of ways, it's a shame because if Hogan doesn't come in, the company probably does go out of business. But a part of me sort of wishes he hadn't come in just so we might have gotten Dustin Rhodes as maybe not the absolute top babyface, but sort of a co-equal with Sting. And I think that might have been what would have ended up happening.
Well,
had Hogan
wasn't
not
there
in.
Talk at the time of him being made NWA champion, like reestablishing that title again?
I don't know that, but that sounds perfectly believable to me.
I've heard it with him, and I think I heard it with maybe Lawler as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's perfectly, perfectly believable that would have happened, especially around that time frame. Mm-hmm. You know, Dustin was so good at that point, and I think Dustin was the best wrestler in the United States in 94. I mean, I know a lot of people will say Bret Hart, and, you know, that's fine. I don't think that's a crazy opinion or anything, but
they're quite comparable, actually.
Like
not just ability, but in terms of what they were doing in the ring, too.
Yeah, I see Dustin as the best wrestler in the United States in 1994. And I think that's one of those marquee years where you see a guy, because he was able to carry that feud and because he was able to do so many compelling things over the course of that feud. I mean, I like Jimmy Golden, but Bunkhouse Buck should not have been having matches that good on pay-per-view in 1994.
No. I mean, it was an awful character. I remember that.
Yes. I mean, the feud had no business being as good as it was. I mean, it was clear when they brought in Terry Funk that the idea was to try and give it some legitimacy that it was lacking when you had Colonel Robert Parker and Jimmy Golden and Bunkhouse Buck as the two sort of big guys. But it's just an amazing feud. If anybody has any, if you listen to this and you haven't seen any of this feud at all, just go watch all of it.
Or his WCW work, honestly.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen his WCW work, get in touch with a friend of ours whose name is Will. And it's just fantastic stuff. I think the Stud Stable feud, did it continue into 95 with the Blacktop Bully stuff? Was that still Stud Stable?
Not really. I mean, basically what happened is after War Games was really when the promotion shifted to full-blown Hogan. Like, because there was that weird period where Hogan was under contract and they were building to the Flair matches and stuff. But this was also a tough period for me as a fan, by the way, because this is when WCW stopped running the McAllister Fieldhouse on the Citadel property, which was a much more intimate venue, and the venue I could get into free to. And they started running the North Charleston Coliseum, which opened up in 94. In fact, Flair versus Hogan main evented a show there, I believe a Clash of Champions, that was the first event ever in that building. So it was kind of the end of my free ride to wrestling shows, you know.
That's the one where they had the masked guy who ended up being Brutus Beefcake doing the
I believe tournament. It was. I went to the show and have almost no memory of it, which tells you right away all you need to know about that, what was happening in WCW at the time. You know, the other big highlight for Dustin in 94 was the match with Vader at Clash of Champions that you talked about, that Steven wrote about.
I'd have to watch that. I haven't seen it. This is the time when I was largely away in university in the military, right?
So. Dave, it is every bit as good as the Sting Vader matches.
Really?
Every bit. Oh yeah, no question. It's the famous match with the spot where Dustin's getting pummeled in the corner, and they do the bit where he kind of comes out and does the double leg on Vader, and it gets this massive pop because nobody could believe that somebody had, you know, taken the fight to Vader that way. And Dustin takes these insane bumps. That's another thing. He would take these crazy, and he still does to this day, actually, but he would take these crazy bumps when he was in there with guys like that. And he took some crazy bumps in that. Vader did a reverse wheelbarrow power slam on him at one point in that match. It is an absolutely awesome match. Like, I think I had that maybe even in my top 10 for that same WCW poll I mentioned earlier. It's every bit as good as the Sting Vader match. Every single bit as good. And if it was part of the lasting feud, it probably would be remembered as fondly, but it was just a one-off for Clash of Champions. And then after that is when the stuff with the Blacktop Bully started, and then, of course, that got him fired.
Yeah, so basically WCW in 1995 was having their uncensored show, which was basically supposed to, I think a lot of people felt that it was trying to capitalize off of the popularity of ECW and, you know, do the Extreme Rules type show, but basically they came up with, like, horrible gimmick matches and, like, didn't even follow through with a lot of them.
No, at the time, it was regarded as the worst pay-per-view ever. I mean, that was the overwhelming consensus.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some pretty horrible pay-per-views that were compete with that since, I'm sure, but yeah, it was pretty bad, but they basically did have they did have that match where basically I don't think it's ever been tried since or before where he and Blacktop Bully, a.k.a. Barry Darsow, had the match on the back of the moving truck. And, you know, as opposed to these guys probably having very legitimate, you know, worker safety, you know, complaints about to work in the back of a moving truck, they get fired because they bladed, basically.
Yeah, and the thing about the match is, like, Phil Schneider watched it a few years ago. I may have only been like a year ago. I have no conception of time. And Phil's as big a Dustin mark as you and I are. And he was like, you know, this match is actually really good. And it just got shit on because of the circumstances. And while I wouldn't say it was a really good match, I think that's excessive. It was actually better than I expected when I rewatched it. It actually wasn't that bad. But it's one of those things where the idea is so stupid that that it's hard to overcome the stupidity of what you're watching. Like,
I think probably the only comparison is that junkyard match they had in the WCW later on.
Where like 10 guys got injured.
Yeah.
Every luchador in the roster got hepatitis.
Yeah.
Like, it was one of the, yeah, that was very, that's not a bad comparison. It was one of those things where it's like, the match itself really, I think, was nowhere near as bad as people made it out to be at the time. But it was such an unbelievably stupid idea, and you're watching it, and you can't get over how stupid the idea is. And it was such a huge waste of Dustin Rhodes. Like, here's a guy who just a couple months before had that match with Vader. I think that was in November of 94, and he had come off this really strong feud with the Stud Stable earlier in the year, where he was able to, not like I said, not necessarily carry the promotion, but carry a meaningful feud. And now he's wrestling the Blacktop Bully in the back of a flatbed truck going through the roads of Tupelo, Mississippi, or wherever the hell it was. I mean, you literally can't come up with, like, you want to talk about, like, people talk about Daniel Bryan's push being saddled, or like Dolph Ziggler's. They've never had to do that. Like, that's just, it's so stupid it defies logic that anybody would have thought it was a good idea, but so was WCW in 1995. Pre-Nitro 95 WCW is painful to watch, boy. It is painful stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the same show where Hogan defeated Vader in a strap match by beating Flair.
Who was in drag, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and retired. So, although those Be Fair to Flair interviews where he was campaigning to come back are pretty funny.
Yeah.
All that being said, you know, we're an hour and a half into this, and we haven't even talked about his WWF. And so my memory of this is that, I mean, again, this is back in G.I. Musgrave, you know, seeking his B.A. So I was barely ever in one place to watch wrestling, but I did manage to catch it whenever I could, which was actually still a fair amount, just not as obsessively as we're able to now. But what I do remember from the summer of 95 is I was home, I was some point watching it on TV. I do actually remember watching with basically the mess hall full of people, the match where Dick Slater and Bunkhouse Buck defeated Harlem Heat for the WCW tag title. Anyways, I just remember seeing this ad for, it was just one of those very early vignettes where they said, you will remember the name of Goldust, and, but they didn't show him or anything, they just had the name and just like this over voiceover of it.
Yep.
And then later on I saw this vignette and, you know, he had the blonde wig on and all the makeup and I had no idea who it was. And I was like, what the hell is this? You know? And then it was in August. So that was like August 95 before he'd actually had a match on TV. And then I was home in Cape Breton in between, you know, working in the military for the summer, going away to university again in the fall. And WWF was in town, and I didn't go to it, but I was at the bar afterwards, and all the guys were there. And, you know, so there's Bret Hart's out, you know, Shawn Michaels is out working his magic with the girls. Well, Duke Drosy was there. And then I see Dustin Rhodes there, and I'm like, what? And I'm like, what is he doing here? I guess he's starting. And then I see someone pointing to him and go, yeah, he's wrestling there. It's Goldust now. And I'm like, oh, my God, that is so cool. And, you know, it made sense once I heard it. But, like, I just – and he was so huge, man. He's like –
yes.
So, and he was just drinking by himself.
The thing I remember is at the time – I used to watch all the shows with a buddy of mine in town, like all the pay-per-views in a less than legal fashion. That was very easy to do back before cable was fully the way it is now. But I also would oftentimes watch the regular TV with him at the time too. And I remember when the vignette started, and at the time actually, there was actually a boarder who lived with him and his mom. Like he rented a room. This guy he was a wrestling fan too, but he was like almost entirely a WWF fan, and we were not entirely WCW fans, but that was our preferred company still, even throughout all the Hogan stuff.
Up until Hogan took over was the alternative product, right?
Sure, and I remember Goldust. I remember Goldust did a vignette, and you know. The guy, his name was Bob, he really tried to pitch it as they were somehow going to make this like a big family-friendly vignette, and like it wasn't as risque as it was because WWF always did family-friendly stuff. I mean, literally this conversation actually happened, which is kind of hilarious in hindsight. And it turned out that in a lot of ways, Goldust was one of the very first of the risque sort of controversial gimmicks that would, you know, really drive the WWF going forward. I mean, in no way am I saying he was
the very first actor.
Yeah, I mean, he may have been the very first. In no way am I saying he was the biggest piece of the puzzle or anything close to that, but he was on the front end of that.
I got to tell you, though, like, so he debuted in 95, had his Survivor Series win over Bam Bam Bigelow, who, you know, had the match with Lawrence Taylor earlier that year. Then tried to turn babyface, and it got fizzled for political reasons, is what you hear. But, you know, that was still a pretty significant win to have on pay-per-view. And then worked towards the Royal Rumble at 96. And, yeah, that's when he started doing that risque stuff with Razor Ramon and, you know,
yep.
basically flirting with him on TV. And, you know, there were subtleties to it at first. And, you know, it was pretty brilliant. And, you know, like... sending him roses and that kind of stuff. And, you know, apparently Scott Hall actually legitimately was too creeped out by it to actually really go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I've always theorized that actually hurt him a lot because that's, in theory, that character should, I mean, in theory, the Goldust character and the Mankind character that would start shortly thereafter, even though they were still sort of cartoony characters, they weren't at the same time. They were cartoony characters.
In a new direction.
Yes, they were cartooning characters that could fit within the realm of what WWF was trying to do. And I always felt like Goldust got saddled and shifted aside in large part because, you know, Scott Hall didn't like working with him. And then Sean, even though Sean got paired up with him for house shows and stuff in 96, there were a lot of people who felt like those house shows were the absolute height of, and I remember this at the time from reading the newsletters and actually from seeing one of the shows live. There are a lot of people who felt like that was the absolute peak of Sean not giving a shit and not trying at house shows at all. I've always thought that...
This is Sean as world champ?
Yes. And I've always thought that Goldust was kind of seen as an outsider by those guys, and I think that that probably really hurt him, because I'm not saying he should have been a main event guy at that point, but he could have been. He absolutely could have been. Could have been a guy that got more main events, and he wasn't. I don't think he was fully utilized, especially for as much heat as he was getting. I mean, they did the Piper thing, which a lot of it was kind of uncomfortable. But
well,
they did
yeah,
the Piper thing.
I mean, if I could just go, basically what they
yeah.
started up with is that, you know, he was obsessed with Hollywood, right? And, you know, he would always quote movies and stuff like that. And it was pretty interesting promos the way he'd do it.
Yes.
And then kind of the way it started was that this was all an act, and it was part of him being a great actor that he was pretending to come on to Scott Hall. But then he's challenging Dusty Roddy Piper and, you know, blowing out a bagpipe and stuff like that. And they kind of went totally back in that direction. And then he had Marlena with him, so... while at first it seemed like it was all about him, you know, being psychological and having mind games and being, you know, more obsessed with Hollywood than anything, they went totally with the homophobic angle. And
yeah, and the thing is, I thought he was a great promo.
Probably where the money was, too, right? What's that?
Yeah, but he was a great promo, though, Dave. Like you said,
he was.
I mean, like, he was a, like, it's kind of funny because Dustin Rhodes, not that he was a bad promo in WCW, but this is what's sort of weird. And we're not going to have time to go nearly in depth with his WWF run as with WCW. But what's weird is, in the WWF at this point, he was a great promo, but it's hard to find a lot of matches that really stand out during this initial
Goldberg run.
No, because
they had him doing the disqualification heavy heel champion run.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, actually, you're right. But another part of it is, I always thought that a big part of it was he put so much into the character. I don't want to say it necessarily hurt his ring work, but I don't think that was his focus anymore. To me, it was like a guy like, okay, I've already mastered this side of the game, so now I'm going to try and master this other side of the game. And it didn't hurt that he wasn't necessarily paired off with guys who he could have had really good matches with. I mean, yeah, he could have had really good matches with Savio Vega probably, but at that point in the WWF, it was a completely different animal than it would be a few years later. You know,
yeah.
by 2001, 2002, really good TV matches were very, very common. But
they had that weird booking where they vacate the title and come back a week later rather than just having the quick title change and stuff.
Yep.
Like,
it yep.
was really confused, weird, bad booking, you know, at the time, too.
Yeah, it was odd.
Yeah. But that being said, I'll tell you that Goldust, like when I was telling, this is when I was like really ramping up with getting as into wrestling as I ever had been at that point, because when I went back to university that year, I had a TV in my room, which actually made a huge difference, because I didn't have to try to convince other people to watch it with me. So I was talking about wrestling a lot, and it's when I first got on the internet, and everyone was talking about Goldust at this point. Everyone thought it was the coolest, funniest thing. And, yeah, he had a big year in 96. You know, he had the IC title run. Just perfect. Perfect guy to be the champion at that point in time.
Yes.
Razor with it. And then eventually lose it to Ahmed Johnson, who was the right guy to win it from him, even though things went down for him later. I'd say it was the right guy to win it from him at the time. They could have ramped him up into being a bigger contender at the point, but they teamed him up with a Mankind, Mick Foley, and some of that stuff was brilliant, I thought. Where you'd have the interviews where, you know, because Mankind would always be talking about Uncle Paul and stuff like that, and crying and stuff in his interviews pretty much, and I just remember they had this one promo in particular where Goldust is sitting there with him, and Mankind has his head on Goldust's lap, and Goldust is just stroking his hair, and I think Mankind was even calling him mommy and stuff like that. Just completely insane.
Which, and, by the standards of that time on TV, was way crazier than it sounds now, too.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, it sounds pretty crazy now, you know, but that was insane at the time. And I saw them live, actually, against Taker and Michaels in Sydney, Nova Scotia. And they had the great thing where I've talked about on the show before where it was just before Halloween, and they brought out a – Goldust brought out a Mankind brought out a jack-o'-lantern and handed it to Goldust, and Goldust is like, "What? For me?" And Mankind shaking his head yes, and then they hug and, you know, just do the jumping hug all around the ring, and it was so great. Yeah. So, but then that kind of went by the wayside, and going into 97 is when he had his babyface turn, and that was pretty powerful stuff, actually. I remember because Marlena was with him all through this year, and she was great in that role too, when they were heels.
Yep, I agree. She added a lot to that act. You know,
sitting in the director's chair with a cigar.
Yep.
Yeah, and they had the Mark Merrill stuff too, and then China debuted with Triple H, and just ravaged her. Just really, you know, it was a pretty savage attack that they had, and, you know, really got China over strong, and got the turnover strong as well. I thought he was pretty good as a babyface that year.
He was real good as a babyface. He was part of Canadian Stampede.
Yeah.
And he seemed like a guy who belonged in that match against the Hart Foundation. And
yeah,
to me, this is another area where I think...
That's what would be interesting to revisit, is some of his ring work that year. Does he,
I think that's a window where he may have been really good and nobody was paying attention. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
but I thought it was a missed opportunity. I thought that whole year was a missed opportunity. That's another year where I thought he could have been a bigger deal. And then they ended up doing the stuff with Pillman, and then... God bless him. I love Brian Pillman, and I want to do a show on him soon, too, actually. But
Yes. That
was not, you know, Pillman was a shell of his former self by that point, and that angle was, it just wasn't good for anybody, I don't think.
It was too psychologically harsh, you mean?
I think it was an angle that made both guys look like less of stars than they were.
Yeah.
And that those are the sort of angles that drive me crazy. I mean,
because I remember people thinking Pillman was a big deal from it.
It was, to me, I just, by that point, I kind of almost hated seeing Pillman on TV because it made me sad that he was never going to be the star I wanted him to be. And Dustin, by that point, I was really ready for him to break out and become a single star on his own. And that feud sort of reinforced the fact that was not going to happen. So, I don't know.
You know,
I mean, for those people who don't know, they did an angle where, you know, Brian Pillman basically stole Marlena and shot these X-rated tapes. And it was sort of like you didn't know whether she was a hostage to him or whether she was actively interested in him. It was, I don't know.
Something else we not to mention is, I mean, the Mick Foley interviews with Jim Ross from that year were really well known, or really remembered well. But, I mean, what actually preceded that was that he did an interview with Goldust where he came out as Dustin Rhodes. You know, we talked about having not talked to his father in years, and calling out to him and asking to establish contact. And I think it legitimately was part of that happening, is what I heard at the time. And it was pretty powerful stuff, and really, really was a really good interview, where he was basically, it was the first time he was ever seen on camera, you know, during that WWF run without all his makeup on. So, and then that kind of inspired the Mick Foley stuff. So, I bet you his 97 stuff is probably worth rewatching. I do know... I think it was in 97 that he started the whole thing where Did he? Yeah, it was in 97, I think, where he started the whole the preaching thing, where he was he burned the gold dust costume and he started preaching on commentary and stuff.
Eat me.
Yeah, do you remember that happening?
I remember the Eat Me angle, which I think is the same angle you're talking about, where they did the Eat Me stood for like evangelist. Shit, I don't remember what it stood for, but it was like evangelist something, and
yeah.
They did this gimmick where he was like born again. And the big, actually, it was kind of genius in a way. It's just a shame that it was, because he burned the rubber suit, and they, you know, he kind of spoke out against the moral decadence. It was sort of like a right to censor thing, but you know. Done with a slightly different twist.
Well,
and
I think there are two things that were really a weakness to it. One is that I think that's when he was really starting to struggle with some personal demons. I think reading a book, that's the case. Although his book is tough because he describes his psychology and his work really well, but chronologically it's stuff of nightmares.
Yeah.
So, I couldn't believe how bad the chronology was in it. But that being said, So I think he was battling with personal demons at the time, and the biggest thing to me, actually, that made that unsuccessful was the look, because they basically just had him in jeans and, like, a bandana, which I don't know. Maybe if they went back to just more of a more wrestling look, it would have worked better.
That works for George South, but not for Dustin Rhodes.
Yeah.
I love George South because you'll see him on, like, shows in the Carolinas working as a heel with the bandana on and looking rugged and mean, but he has John 3:16 on his tights.
Yeah.
It's like, what a great message to send.
Yeah. I think if Dustin had gone back to, like, actually looking like a wrestler at that point rather than looking like he was trying to be some kind of street guy.
Well what they did, but the angle itself was kind of cool because remember they did the thing where he was in the crowd or whatever and he was holding the signs like he's coming back or whatever. And they thought, like, you know, it was kind of, you kind of thought, like, this is, because they were playing with the religious stuff. So it was kind of almost like a... second coming of Jesus, like, what the hell? But in the back of, I think, a lot of people's mind, everybody knew it was going to be the Goldust character coming back, and that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, and that was the weirdest Goldust stuff. It was some fun stuff with the impersonations and stuff, but it was really whack.
Well, that was, see, that thing is, at that point, the Attitude Era was a full tilt, though. I mean, like...
So it's certainly not on him, but... Some of it, but I mean, it was also throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and seeing what worked, and some of it didn't
work.
I remember he did the Dusty stuff, and that was pretty funny.
They did all the ball gag, crazy stuff with, you know,
yeah.
And then they brought in Luna with them, and I mean, God bless her. Like, I got nothing against the lady, and, you know, she's dead now, and actually she was a hard worker as a wrestler, but I think that really hurt him, just being associated with her period, and... Because she didn't have, like, anything about her that made you... To me, she wasn't somebody that would ever be managing a top talent. And he... Like, the character at that point was... I got the feeling, like, it was the bizarre comic relief ideas of a man who once wanted to stuff crushed leaves in his cousin's vagina.
It was about the comic relief and trying to get shock value out of segments rather than trying to make it some kind of mind games that would play with anyone.
There was nothing really. I mean, they did a storyline, I think, with Val Venus maybe, but there was nothing that made you interested in the character. By that point, I was actually happy when things washed out and he ended up out of the company, which is crazy to say because he'd been my favorite, or close to my favorite guy just a few years before. But,
although it's not something that you would typically put over, I do remember when Owen died, he had a really, really nice speech about Owen on the tribute show, too, right?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I do remember that. But, Dustin, the last couple of years in that first WWF run, we're not a high point.
So then he ends up going into WCW, and they started these, like, angles that were probably creepier than Goldust, where he was basically a cross between Mike Myers and some kind of child rapist, I guess.
I don't think that was the intent. Like, it's one of those things where, like...
That
you know,
it got said that that's what it was, And yeah,
people always mock WCW standards and practices, like our TBSs and TNTs. Like you know, that was kind of always the defense for the Russo apologist and for Russo himself was always that, well, they hamstrung him and wasn't able to do the things that he had to do because they had all these arcane rules that didn't work in that time frame, and that it, you know, WWE could do whatever they wanted, but they were stuck doing these other things. But then when you go back and look at this stuff, you're like, come on, dude.
That being said, in Dustin's book, he actually really regrets that they made him trash that gimmick because he thought there's all room to go with it.
Well, the worst thing, the reason it was so bad, I think, is because they built up this gimmick and they did this big entrance, and then the very first night he debuted, he immediately trashed it, which I've never seen anything like that ever in wrestling. Like, you know, in some ways that was the apex of your sort of crash TV, not necessarily even just Russo, but like that sort of Russo-esque mentality of how you book guys. Like,
but also the angles were happening as Russo took over.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it was crazy stuff because there was no reason for them to do that storyline at all, and then they did it, and they invested all this money and time into it, obviously, and then they immediately junked it, and they clearly didn't have any really major plan for him afterward, which made it even more weird.
But he did have a hefty run there where he was teaming, where his dad came back, and he teamed with his dad against Rick and David Flair, too, right?
Oh, dude, I like a lot of that stuff, you know. I guess he did the American Nightmare thing, I think, at some point there. But he was fun at that point. You could tell, I think, that some of his decisions, so to speak, had taken a toll on him because he wasn't as good as he had been just a few years before. But he was one of the only guys in WCW that felt like he was trying hard during that period, which goes a long way with me because there was really no reason for him to try hard.
Yeah.
And a couple years before that, you know, during the absolute low points of the Goldust stuff, I really don't think he was trying at all.
We'll get to that point in a minute.
He worked hard. He worked really hard. I mean, he had that fun match with Terry Funk. It wasn't really a great match, but it was fun. And, yeah, he had some good stuff with his dad for sure during that period.
And kind of would be seen as some of the highlights of latter days WCW as well.
Yes. Actually, sadly, because it wasn't exactly great, but it was certainly some of the more watchable stuff in the dying days of WCW.
Yeah, and then he ends up. I remember when WCW went down, and Vince had that thing where he trashed a bunch of people like Jeff Jarrett and Lex Luger, and he trashed both of us because apparently there'd been a thing. I remember having heard about it before, where Goldust was in WWE, where he'd actually proposed getting implants.
Yes.
Which would have been, if he'd done it, would have been pretty extreme.
Just a little.
Just a little.
I thought I heard
of maximum about a guy who did do that on a bet.
The idea of a transsexual gimmick at that point in wrestling, wow. I don't even... I mean, Goldust was already playing with that idea in some ways, but to have gone full-blown...
Certainly would have been some media, but
yeah, that's true.
So then, what did he do in the rest of 2001? Go ahead.
I mean, he might have been working indies, but he didn't come into WWE until early 2002, right?
Right. Yeah. So he came into WWE in 2002. He was in the Royal Rumble that year, as was Mr. Perfect, and I think they even teamed them up on the road for a bit, didn't they?
That sounds right, but I don't remember.
I think it was actually maybe Mr. Perfect and Mr. Perfect and Big Boss Man that they did that with. So
okay.
Yeah, he's in WWE in 2002. He feuds with Maven, or at least he does some stuff over the Hardcore title. You know, trades it with Maven, trades it with Taz. Ends up working with Rob Van Dam over it as well. You know, that Hardcore title was pretty fun at that point, but trying to trace the lineage of it is the stuff of nightmares as well. So, And yeah, he was in there for a good period that year. Actually, it looks like he was actually there the whole year.
Well, 2002 was where the Gold Dust and Booker T team started.
Yeah. So
and that was, you know, see, and again, we're going to have to kind of rush through some of this stuff because otherwise it'd be a 5-hour podcast. But
yeah.
The thing about that period is everybody talks about the SmackDown 6 in 2002. And in no way am I going to shit on that stuff because it was really good stuff and it was different for the time and really stood out then and it stands out now. But Raw, part of the reason I think it stood out was how bad Raw was by comparison. Raw was just fucking wretched. Some of the, like, I mean, let's be honest. If Triple H is the ace of the show, it's going to suck.
Yeah.
And he was the ace of the, so, you know, it really was not good except for the Booker T and Goldust feud with Christian and Chris Jericho. And they had tremendous matches. They had a match at the No Mercy pay-per-view, which had the same match that everybody loved that won all the awards that year with Ray and Edge versus, was it Angle and Benoit, I guess. On the same show, they had a match. And I thought it was every bit as good as that match. And then they had a match on Raw that went really long by the standards of Raw at the time. And that match was even better than that match. So they had, like, Goldust to me in 2002 was the best worker on Raw. He was totally rejuvenated. He was, the shame of that year is that he was working on Raw and not SmackDown. Because on SmackDown, he would have had a lot of good guys to work with. And on Raw, he basically had Jericho and Christian, and that was it.
And he actually had a, in the build-up to Booker and Triple H at Mania, he had the title match with Triple H on Raw.
Yeah, and the promos with Goldust and Booker T were great stuff, too, because they sort of harkened back to the original Goldust gimmick with the Hollywood fixation, and they do the movie reviews, and it was an amusing dynamic. My favorite period in Booker T's career, actually.
Yeah, and then going into 2003 is when he started doing the stuff where he tried to get Lance Storm to lighten up.
Yeah, and 2003 was Tourette's Gold Dust too, right?
Yes, I actually was there when they started that live. They had that in Toronto.
Let me tell you, of all the ridiculous, nonsensical gimmicks WWE has ever done, and this is 100% true, and you can, sadly, I've been posting online, there's a well-documented posting history of this if you look in the right places. I thought Tourette's Gold Dust was like the best stupid gimmick they ever did.
He ran with it too, right?
I thought it was fucking hilarious. Like I still think it's funny. Like even now. And again, it's sort of sad because it's a guy who really could have been much more than that, who was relegated to doing that. But again, like you said, he ran with it. And I thought, you know, he was still good in the ring at that point and he was comedic at that point. It's just a shame that he was not put in a position to have matches that meant something because it really got over and it was really funny and it was really distinct on the shows. And I think there might have been a way to get out of that and make him a more serious character, kind of like they did with Bubba Ray Dudley and the stuttering in ECW. But they never really went anywhere with it.
So then that goes into 2004. He was actually working quite a fair amount in Japan that year. Nothing crazy, but he was working in 01 and Hustle. As basically Dusty Rhodes Jr., right? Teamed with Mike Awesome, teamed with Giant Silva, Steve Corino, teamed with Dusty at one point, actually, because Dusty was going over there a lot at that point, against Shinjiro Otani and Satoshi Kojima. I'm sure that actually might be interesting.
Yes.
And he was doing a lot of TNA at that point, too. So he actually had a title match against Jeff Jarrett.
I don't remember that match, but I want to see it. That was in 2004, right, Dave?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And that was when they were still doing the weekly pay-per-views, right?
Yeah, I want to see that match. I imagine that would have actually, in theory, that could have been good.
Yeah. So that goes through 2004. Going into 2005, I'm not sure where he was working that year in 2005. I'm assuming it was TNA again.
Well, he had a lot of, I mean, like, he did the Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling thing with Dusty for a while. I think that might have been
a
little before
that. Yeah, that was in 2001 going into 2002. Yeah, that's what he was
doing. Yeah, And I know he worked some indies in the mid part of the decade, but he wasn't a super active wrestler at that point, which makes his current run even crazier if you think about it.
Yep. So, and then basically, yeah, he had to come back and WWE starting around. He was in and out really for a few years, and then he started there again in 2009, and that was looked at as a great run. That's when he had a run where he put over, where he really was part of elevating Sheamus, especially.
He made Sheamus. He made him.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
he was Black Reign in TNA as well.
Yes, Black Reign. We should mention Black Reign, which I think is the absolute low point of his career. To me, like, it's kind of weird because Dustin is a guy who has these periods where he doesn't try very hard. This is so weird, by the way, saying Dustin, because I'm thinking of my brother as I'm talking about Dustin Rhodes. But
yeah.
he has these periods where he doesn't try very hard, or at least he comes across that way. And I don't know if it's he just realizes how shitty the situation is, or if he's just out of shape. Or what? And I hate even taking jabs at the guy because he's such a favorite of mine. But to me, Black Reign was the absolute low point because it was like trying to mix sort of a evil heel, cartoonish monster guy with certain aspects of the Goldust character,
mm-hmm.
but in an absolutely awful promotion where virtually nothing was ever any good. Although at that time, that was probably the best period in the history of TNA, right around that time. But it just was not good at all, you know. And I remember when he came back to the WWF or WWE, I remember thinking, that last run was real bad, you know. Like, I remember thinking, okay, I don't even know if I want to see this. And, dude, he made Sheamus. I mean, when Sheamus first debuted, I don't know if I've ever told this story before on the show, but I had a friend of mine who was a casual fan, wasn't a huge fan. He happened to be over at my house in Devon, who's actually done the show with us a couple times. He was staying with me that summer. And they did it, you know, ECW sort of did, they almost had seasons on WWE ECW, and they sort of launched this new season of the show, kind of, where they re-debuted all these guys. It was probably the worst episode of WWE ECW ever. I think it was also the episode where the Abraham Washington show debuted. But Sheamus came out, and he had that ridiculous music, and he'd never been on TV before, and he walks through, and he's got this big Celtic cross, and he's pale white, and with a goofy look. And my buddy, who was over the house, my buddy Jono, died of laughter. I mean, like, uncontrollable laughter for, like, 5 minutes at how ridiculous this guy looked. And I remember thinking then, this guy has got no fucking chance. It doesn't matter if he's good or not. You know, there's no, if the casual fan response is to die laughing for 5 minutes upon sight of you, that's not good. And then the Goldust feud totally made them. You know, I mean, yes, it was on B and C level shows or whatever term you want to use, but they had really good matches.
That was really the best, some of the best use they've had of that format. Like, that's what it should be, right?
Absolutely. I really feel like it made him. And it wasn't long after Sheamus was moved over to Raw that he won the title from John Cena. You know, so they had a lot of faith in him, you know. And I think at least partially that may have been due to, I mean, obviously part of it was that Triple H title the guy, maybe most of it. But I don't think it hurt that he was able to have a good match with Dustin.
It is largely attributed to Dustin putting him over as well. And him going with it as well. He pulled his part of it too, right?
Sure, yeah. Dustin also had good matches with, you know, during the same time period as when he had one really good TV match with Regal. That might have been in 2010, but they had a really good TV match. And also during that run was the Yoshitatsu team, which I thought was a good team.
Yeah.
And another good use of Dustin, by the way, because they at least theoretically were pairing him with, you know, a talented young guy that they were trying to get over. Of course, now Tatsu does nothing, which is a huge waste of him, but.
After 5 years almost, he's still doing nothing, right?
So. Yeah, which is ridiculous. I mean, come on. Shit or get off the pot with this poor guy, right? But
yeah. Is it really that hard to imagine the most racist promotion on the planet turning a Japanese guy heel? At least trying.
But, yeah, that the Goldust and Tatsu team was good, too. I mean, he had a lot of good matches on the C-shows. He had a good match with Jericho on Superstars, I think, in 2010, like a really good, like, 15-minute match. He was having really good matches throughout that entire run. But he was also, you know, he wasn't portrayed as a star during that run like he is now. He was a guy that was there to get other guys over.
Yeah, but he was getting really appreciated for his in-ring work, and then he gets injured. And then that, you know, he basically had a, you know, I guess he was an agent for a while there in 2011. And then they let him go, and he was basically healed up enough to start working again. I think it's a good way to do it, because then he had another way to make money. But, yeah, so then he was basically on the indies again for a couple years, and then he basically shows back up this fall out of nowhere. I don't think he'd had any appearances in the meantime, right?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like, they kind of – he had made that big deal out of the stuff with Cody. He did the thing at the Royal Rumble with Cody. I don't remember what year that was. But and
oh
I
yeah, he had had one Rumble shot. Yeah, that's right.
And he made that. He kind of made the deal out of how he wanted to wrestle his brother at WrestleMania, which at the time would have been pretty preposterous. By the way, now it actually seems like a good undercard match for Mania. But at the time, I mean, as much as a fan as I am of Goldust, it was purely fantasy booking, really. You know, that had come out and had been mentioned, and he went out and he didn't get signed.
I got to be honest. You know, all this stuff about how great a worker he was in 2010, you know, like I thought he was. But I figured at this age with having an injury, he must be done.
I mean, no. This is a guy who's had multiple resurgences. But, yeah, I totally agree. Like, you know, I don't think anybody really thought he was ever going to come back in any way, shape, or form. Maybe at the most he'd come in for like a one-off Royal Rumble appearance again or cheap pop here or there on like a Legends show or kind of the Sergeant Slaughter role where if somebody's denigrating the veterans, he comes out. I mean, I don't think anybody really thought anything else of it. He did have a excellent match with Sami Callihan in December, I think December 17th of last year on a PWS show. And I mean, a really good
interesting stuff.
Yes. And it was one of those matches that it wasn't around for a long time, and I finally saw it not that long ago, and it kind of foretold the run that he would have now. Because
it was kind of like basically out of nowhere. I mean, basically they were trying to build up Orton and the whole Daniel Bryan feud. And, you know, Cody Rhodes was going on vacation. You know, he was getting married and going to be going on his honeymoon. So they had this whole thing where they've done it a million times, where if you lose, you're fired, and I was so tired of it. This is maybe some of the best use they've ever made out of that, I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
I thought it was excellent. I thought the whole angle, the only pause.
But when they started it, I was like, yeah, right, like, who cares? But then when it leads to Goldust coming in and having that great match, and then all the stuff since, it's like, see, sure, nobody buys the stakes, but everyone got into the emotional stakes of, you know, Goldust and Cody having the run again.
Yeah, I think the fact that the players involved were actually probably better than the story itself, although I think the story itself was well done. The thing about the story was, in previous years, this would have been done over the span of like 3 or 4 months, but now you have to do it in a month because that's just the pay-per-view cycle.
Well,
and
there's as much happens in a month as used to happen in 3 or 4.
That's
months.
Right, exactly. The media landscape is totally different, so you have to do things quicker. That's why it always makes me laugh when people talk about like how they have to do these slow burns or whatever, and I'm like, in theory you're right, but it's not as easy as people make it sound. But anyway.
They
could
make it slower sometimes, but yeah.
Yeah, like the way that broke down, like first of all, Cody and Orton had a hell of a match in the match where Cody got fired. That was one of the best Cody Rhodes singles matches I've ever seen. And, you know, then you were there live for the Goldust match, right?
Loved it. Loved it. It was so awesome. I actually,
yeah,
you know, like I didn't think there was any way he was going to win, but they had you buying those near falls. And you were so into them as well. The whole building was going nuts. And they did such a great job of building him up, his history all night.
Yes. Yeah, the way they set it up was great. I mean, honestly, and then to bring in Dusty after that, and they did, and added that element, because Dusty's such a great talker. And he's such a charismatic presence, even when the actual promo itself isn't that great. His presence is so strong that it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just... The build to that, the pay-per-view match that they set up where they got their jobs back. You know, that was awesome. The use of the Shield and all this I thought was genius, because the Shield, it's, I don't want to say they've been de-elevated, but they've been sort of pushed to the back burner, and I feel like this sort of raised their profile back up.
Yeah, for sure.
it raised their profile back up. And honestly,
and maybe
this whole,
part of Roman Reigns, the big push for Roman Reigns too.
I absolutely think it is. I think this has rekindled the tag division too. I mean, right now the WWE, I think I said this on Alan's show the other night, but we get, you know, the WWE gets criticized all the time for the way the top guys are pushed and the way the angles are done. And I agree with a lot of that, maybe even most of it. But they've done a great job with the tag division in the last 3-4 months, and it's largely because the Rhodes brothers are a team people believe in. Like, they absolutely believe they're stars. They absolutely believe that they can be in there with main event guys. They believe that they can be in there and have good matches with anybody on the roster.
And the comparison I made the other night on Alan's show is, you know, like on Bret Hart's DVD, his first DVD, he talked about, you know, basically, you know, the Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation coming in and, you know, kickstarting, lighting a fire underneath the tag team division, and, you know, not letting these old guys have these bad matches. And, you know, that in this case, it's not these old guys. It's kind of, you know, these young guys, or this bad booking at least. But they've really lit a fire underneath the tag team division.
There's just been some great stuff with these. I mean, Dustin Rhodes, Goldust, whatever the hell name. I mean, honestly, you know, and you're the guy who's got him number two. You know, I've kind of got him knocking on the door to the top five. I'm not sure where he's going to be with me at the end of the year. He could finish conceivably. I mean, I don't want to say he could. It'd be hard for him to pass Rush or Negro Casas. And at this point, after seeing the match he had with William Regal, I don't think anybody's passing Cesaro. But
yeah, I got to watch that still.
You know, it's a tremendous match. But having said that, you know, I would strongly consider putting Dustin in the top three or four guys in the world. You know, I mean, he's been incredible.
I honestly think you could look at this run right now and some of the stuff he does, and so much of it is body language too, right?
Yes.
It's bumps. Yes, it is bumps. It's pace, it's intensity, but just the way he tells the story in the ring is just so great. And I honestly think, you know, with I understand that Triple H apparently wants to make 2014 a big tag team year. I fully support that, because I think any majorly successful era for them, be it the 80s or the late 90s, has had a solid tag team division. I think that would be a big part of things getting to another level again. But I think if they do it, they really need to thank Goldust.
I mean, he's been so good. And the thing is, the guy, like, it's one thing, when you see these older guys who have really great timing and have really great psychology and all that, you expect that. I mean, that's something you expect out of a really great old guy.
Broken down, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you expect Jerry Lawler to work matches that are really compelling based on timing and psychology even now, because those are the things that he's great at, and physically he's limited, but he's not completely out of shape, you know, so he can do those things. But with Dustin, it's like he's the best. I mean, the guy's got the deepest offensive moveset in the entire company. Every single match, he does a new offensive move. He runs the ropes faster than anybody else. He's the only guy who's had a match with the Shield all year and taken crazier bumps than Seth Rollins.
Yeah, and as far as why I would have him ranked so high, I really see the work he's doing right now as trendsetting and changing. He could change the business with this stuff.
It's kind of a hybrid approach in some ways, because, you know, I always talk about guys on the indies who I like that are Southern workers, lots of times who are lesser known or maybe not talked about as much, who are really good at sort of straddling the fence between your sort of traditional psychology-based, timing-based matches and your more modern, for lack of a better term, indie influence, sort of high spot heavy stuff. And Goldust is kind of doing that same thing in the WWE. And I think he does it. I mean, he has the best face and peril segments you'll ever see in these matches. I mean, that match at TLC, that face and peril segment he has in that match is, I mean, it's as good a face and peril segment as I've ever seen in a wrestling match. Like, and you know, the payoff when he makes his comeback or when you know you're going to see something cool from him. You know you're going to see a cool spot. It's going to be something you didn't expect. By the same token, when he's in there with somebody like the Wyatts, you can totally believe him as a guy who can have a slugfest with, you know, Luke Harper. Or he's completely credible in so many different settings and against so many different opponents. And he does so many things right, both big picture and little picture. He just has there's not anybody in wrestling. I mean, this is not a knock, because there are guys in the WWE who have had excellent years, particularly Daniel Bryan and Antonio Cesaro, in my opinion, and The Shield. But there's nobody like him right now.
As far as having that great tag team stuff and, you know, like revolutionary work rate stuff and coming back at an older age, it's like a cross between Ricky Morton, Fit Finley, and Daniel Bryan.
Yeah, that's not a bad, that's not really, I kind of see what you're doing there. I kind of see where you're going with that. I don't disagree with that. What's so amazing about this run to me, what's so amazing about this run to me, Dave, is that it's not so much that he has a great run, because we've seen him disappear for a while and come back and be really good. I mean, he's done it a couple of times. What's weird about it is that he's doing it in a way that you completely didn't expect. I mean, you did not expect him to be good in this way. And, you know, as much as I love him in the tag team setting, I hope he gets some more singles matches. I've not seen the swagger match.
Doing, you know, so much for him and for Cody.
At first, I thought it was going to hurt Cody because Goldust is so much more over than Cody. But I think slowly, especially over the last couple weeks, I'm starting to come around to your position, which is that it's really going to help Cody, because Cody has really developed, especially as a hot tag, into a guy that is like a really good compliment to his brother and that team. And I think you're probably right. I think the end of the day, it is going to help Cody a lot.
I think he's going to come out of it as a babyface that's really good at changing gears. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And
I'm watching,
you know,
his brother in there.
He's in there with the master of babyface selling. I mean, there isn't anybody any better. Goldust, as a face in peril, is right up there with the all-time greats. That I'm sure will sound hyperbolic to people, and I mean, if you force me at gunpoint, I'd pick a couple of guys over him. But he is
the all-time great, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's right. He's right.
And we've
there
seen it before, and it's stuff where he's teamed with Barry, you know, and
yep.
And you know, even his tag team with Booker T and stuff like that, and then you bring in the stuff that he did as Goldust. And what's basically what's so awesome about this run right now is it brings in all the awesome elements of everything he's ever done before, except maybe heel psychology. Because
I think we'll see that before it's over.
I think we'll see that, yeah. And I think other heels are getting great heel psychology out of working with him.
I agree. I just hope I hope this is not a run that's going to end at Mania. You know, I get the feeling that may have been the original intention, but I think there's a lot more mileage that can get out of this guy. I mean, to me, if you listen to the live crowds, the only guys in the company that are more over than him are Daniel Bryan and John Cena.
Yeah, I think the only way this will end at Mania is if he ends up in a role where he trains the future greats, where they make him
block. Well, if they put him down at NXT and put him in sort of a regal role, I would be perfectly fine with that. You know, as long as we get to see him a few times a year, because he's got a lot left in his tank. I mean, he is nowhere near forced retirement age.
No.
I mean, I would say for the last, really since he came back, he's been the best guy in the world. I mean, he maybe not for the whole year, because, you know, you have to factor in the full year, but since he's been back, he's been the best guy in wrestling.
Yeah, especially the past month. It's come. Well, no, all the stuff before that too, though. So yeah, basically since he's come back in October, September, I guess, because that's when Steven and I saw him at Raw. So, yeah, you know what? I mean, Will's done that Dustin Rhodes set and had planned on doing a Goldust set, and I think after, you know, or at least later in this run would be a really good time to put that one together too. You know, like maybe show some of the worst moments from WCW and TNA as well, just to show what happened there. And he did have a match in Japan as well where he wrestled as Goldust. But, you know, you could really put together a lot of great stuff from his Goldust run. So.
Yes. Yeah. He's got plenty of great stuff.
Yeah, and it's like 17 years now that he's had that roll off and on. So.
Yep. It's not been continuous, but it's in a way it has been continuous because it's always seemed like it was on the back burner rather than completely retired.
Yeah.
He's been doing it for a long time. It's in many ways, with the exception of the Undertaker gimmick, it's the only gimmick of its kind that's lasted for any length.
Yeah, and the Undertaker gimmick's gone through so many changes over the years too, right?
Yeah, well, the Goldust gimmick has too, but yeah, you're right. I mean, those two guys though are I guess in Kane to a degree, but those are the guys who've kind of been able to keep that sort of gimmick relevant, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and well, before they did the unification, we'd been saying we were hoping he was going to get a World Heavyweight title run. Might be too much to ask for him to be the unified champion, but man, that would be fun.
Would be awesome.
I don't think it's going to happen, but...
No, I don't either.
No, I don't even know that it should, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't be fun.
Yeah, you never know, though, because if you had told me that Mark Henry would be the world champion in 2011, and not only would that he would be the world champion, but that he would be probably the best promo in wrestling, and that a lot of the people who previously hated him would really like him, and that ratings would and attendance would actually go up when he was champion, I would have been like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
And that he could slam a dunk at basketball.
Yes. But yeah, so you never know. We can dream.
Yeah. Okay. Well, shatter dreams if it doesn't happen. Sorry, that was a really bad, awkward silence. Which you did.
That was the curtain call.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Okay. So now that we've implanted those jokes, we should get going. But
God.
Anyways, good show as always, Dylan. Sorry, everybody. It was a little, quite a lengthy layoff there, but I think schedules are probably looking a little better in the new year for us, and we're planning on doing a year in review show around New Year's, as we've done this will be our third one. And this year I did talk to Tim and he's up for doing it. So as long as his schedule allows at the time, we'll do that as well.
Yeah. So our buddy Tim Livingston will be back. I was talking to him today about, his best matches of the year. And he was in a panic, a mild panic, asking what he needed to watch.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll send him a list of what we watch. I don't think he's going to get it all in, but I'm sure he watched it. And we can pretend we watch it all just to make him panic and make it seem like we're these purists. Well, you have watched it all, so I can watch it all. So
yes, we will pretend with Tim on an upcoming show, hopefully just in a few days, actually. And yeah. I second what Dave said. Thanks, everybody, for being patient with us. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this. If you've made
for
it
all
through
the
this long
of the show.
But,
we might have went on a little too much tonight, but I think we had fun with the show, and I think people will enjoy it. So,
yeah, we did.
Yeah. And, you know, much like Goldust, our talking gets better as time goes by. So
I don't know if that's true or not, but hopefully we don't have a Black Rain era in front of us.
And much like the Goldust gimmick, our podcast lasts forever, so. Anyway,
much like the Goldust gimmick, Dave has Tourette syndrome. On that note,
yes.
We will hopefully be talking again about wrestling in the next few days. And I would just like to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, and of course,
or whichever it is for you, yeah,
Happy New Year as well, because we probably won't talk to again until at least the 1st of January. Hopefully on the 1st, but
yeah. Okay.
All righty.
Thanks for doing the show, Dylan.
Good night. Godspeed.
Talk to you later.